Please join me in welcoming Cormac to traditional Fonte greeting, a Quava.
Thank you so very much, Professor Harrison, and thank you all for making it a point to come in spite of the weather. I think that, you know, the weather might be dreary, but then it's so enlightening in here. It's nice to be in a very bright space. I'd like to thank all the people, the organizers involved in bringing me here, that I'm very excited to be here and to share my work. What I'm going to be presenting to you today is a condensation of what my book manuscript entails. And the book manuscript is entitled Amphibious Subjects, Sasui and the Contested Politics of Queer Self-Making in Neoliberal Ghana. I don't mind the title, the juice and everything will be in the book. So when the book is ready, you should just, you know, be excited and ecstatic for it. I trust me, it's going to be great. And before I actually proceed to talk about my paper today, which is entitled Bargaining with Heteronormativity, I'd like to share with you a brief anecdote, something that actually happened over the break, over the Christmas break. I was back in Ghana to conduct the J-term for students from the University of Virginia. And apparently my cousin, who is actually a professor at the California State University in Fullerton, was also in town. He's a professor of economics. I have a film called Reluctantly Queer, and Professor Harrison clearly made you aware of that. And my cousin had actually we've not been in touch for 10 years. Somehow he had gone online to Google me, right? Thanks to Google, you can find whatever you want, right? So he enters my name, of course, in the search engine, and whatever comes up had to do with the film I had done, and of course the work I do on LGBT human rights politics. So my cousin somehow takes a screenshot of the trailer of the film I made, which is a section in the trailer where I am taking a shower, right? So there's this ladder that I'm literally lathered in soap, right? And so my cousin shows my family, my mother and my father, right, this image of Kwame in this naked pose, right, showering. And so immediately my parents thought I was actually, I live in the US and I was acting pornography. Right, and not just pornography, I was actually acting gay porn. So what immediately happens is that this is what my parents are telling me, that my cousin tells them that I'm an embarrassment to the family. I'm a disgrace to the family, right? So immediately my parents call me to confirm whether what my cousin has said was true, right? Now, think about this. This is a cousin who has never reached out to me, or we've been out of touch for 10 years. And he has been out of touch with my parents for 10 years. He works at a university in California. And you would think that because of his pedigree, that he has some kind of critical consciousness around issues around homosexuality, right? But goes to tell my parents that I'm an embarrassment to the family, and for which my parents are truly troubled about the narrative. So what do I do? It was Christmas, that was when the family got together. At that moment, I told my parents that we can't talk about this. Shall we postpone it? And why is it that they would trust my cousin more than I? Right? So I just want to begin with this anecdote just to highlight the ways in which in my desire, or as part of my desire to preserve this familial unity, right, I bargained with heteronormativity. And I use bargaining here as a heuristic, right? In what ways can we think about bargaining in communities that are oppressed, right? How do oppressed communities in some instances bargain with oppressive ideologies and oppressive practices, right? So the story I'm going to tell you, or the work I'm going to share with you, is an ethnographic narrative amongst a community of self-identified effeminate men in Ghana called Sasui. So what I'm going to share with you is going to be more like a journey that I invite you all to join me in having. In summer 2013, I returned to Ghana to conduct long-term ethnographic fieldwork among a community of self-identified effeminate men, known collectively as Sasui. Sasui is singular, Sasui is plural. Some few weeks into fieldwork, Kobe, one of my key informants, asked me to accompany him to an outdooring in Jamestown, the primary site of my fieldwork, and an old suburb of Accra. So Jamestown is actually like a colonial suburb, right? So here you can see Accra, the capital. You know where Ghana is in West Africa. And now this is like a little shot of, you know, Jamestown and how it looks. It's a coastal community, right, which means that they have a lot of fishermen there. But what is very interesting about this community is just the various degrees of masculinity that are presented here. Not only are there fishermen, it's also a pugilist community. Right, so then most of Ghana's foxes come out of this community, right? So let's just think about why it is that the men I study, who are self-identified effeminate men, choose to live in this community which has such strong masculine presence, right? And thinking about how these, you know, these multiple masculinities are not just entangled, but how they navigate each other's presence. Formerly a colonial outpost, Jamestown is predominated by the Ga ethnic group. And among them, the ceremony is referred to as Pojimo. Can you say that after me? Pojimo?
Pojimo.
It means going through the stead or the doorpost, the threshold of the door, right? So it's like an introducing the baby, the newborn child to the world. Kobe was elated about the event, revealing that, and I quote, "it will be very Sasoe in character, as the couple for whom the ceremony is being organized are Sasoe. They are renowned for their wealth in the community and also for their industriousness," he says softly. Surprised, I responded, "if they are Sasoe, then are they men who have sex with men or merely self-identified effeminate men?" Now, here is Kobe's rejoinder. "No, they are a male and female couple. I know it sounds strange. However, the man is very feminine and the woman very masculine. She was an outstanding footballer," by which she means a soccer player, "whilst in secondary school. Here in Jamestown, she's known for her past achievements in soccer. Her husband runs his own business ventures in the community, which includes a provision store and a little restaurant. Now they have their third child and a baby boy, and we are all very proud. The couple has done such an amazing job taking good care of their children, and the community seems to enjoy their accomplishment. The event will be well attended because of how much respect and status they have accumulated. The outdooring will be special because, you know, we invest a lot of attention and money into these events if we want them to be breathtaking." So this is what Kobe is telling me. And Kobe, mind you, is a self-identified effeminate man. So now here's how Jamestown looks. Jamestown is actually a former colonial trading post, right? So it bears these sort of colonial traces of enslavement, right? So here you can actually see, you can see this is like a former slave fort, this here too. And the fact that you do have this historical edifice in this particular space says a lot about the continuities or the durability of enslavement and colonialism in this particular space. At the time, I understood Sasoe to mean effeminate man. Therefore, Kobe's reference to female Sasoe, and in fact, a seemingly heterosexual couple, appeared utterly contradictory to me. Indeed, while Kobe's revelation challenged my initial assumptions about Sasoe's subjectivities and linguistic conventions, it equally revealed the fluidity and diversity of those experiences and identities indexed by the term Sasoe. Up until then, my knowledge of Sasoe was limited to self-identified effeminate men who have increasingly become targets of the Ghanaian state and transnational LGBT human rights regime. I was later to understand, based on intensified ethnographic interactions and observations, that masculine men and even feminine men, non-feminine men were also integral constituents of Sasoe universe. The outdooring event represented one of my earliest interactions and experiences with the complexity of the community of self-identified effeminate men and those social relations that orbited around Sasoe lives. Hence, the Pojimo, or the outdooring, as a ritual domain, ostensibly presented Sasoe with opportunities to collect and connect, evidenced by the orchestration of the ceremony from scratch. There, what outsiders like myself
would have figured as unimaginable, such as the bonds between heterosexual bodies and non-heterosexual bodies were made possible. From the master of ceremonies to the servers and from ushers to caterers, the event literally ran on the backs of Sasue. During the ceremony, Sasue's subjectivity just refracted like that. A low-income community, Jamestown has such rich history, embodied by colonial and racialized relics, slave castles, dungeons, and former colonial trading posts. In other words, post-colonial Jamestown bears marked traces of colonial times, evidenced by the durability of physical despoliation together with psychical, economic, and cultural estrangement, which are visibly present in the lives of the suburb's residents. In spite of these colonial afterlives or leftovers and post-colonial tragedies, citizens in this space, among them Sasue, navigate the marked effects of the neoliberal and neocolonial collusion, to utilize Patricia McFadden's insightful terminology, very carefully. Evidently, Jamestown functioned as a palimpsestic terrain inhabited by post-colonial subjects who undeniably live and embody scrambled lives. So here is like an example of an outdooring, right? So here you do have like the man and the wife, right? So for the most part, these events occur with Sasue orchestrating them. You cannot have like a ritual like this without having Sasue involved, because their involvement requires a certain degree of dexterity, right? They are imagined as people who are great organizers. They come into the space, and what they are there to do is to make your event or your ritual very vibrant. So just imagine how these self-identified effeminate men, who in this space are regarded as, you know, backing against gender as male and female, are so integral to a heteronormative ritual. Right, a ritual in which a child is gendered. So I'm called Kwame in Ghana. I'm called Kwame because I was born on Saturday. My female counterpart is called Ama. And it is at events like this that is where I become gendered. Right, so you have these queer bodies who are literally entangled, whose services are needed for this event to be successful. And so that's what I'm trying to think about when I say, how are they bargaining with heteronormativity in actually by participating in just rituals? So here, you know, this guy has become a father. So he's also been he's transitioning from being not a dad to a dad. And these are some Sasue who actually were at the event, and they were there to serve food. They were there to sing. They are very they are oratorical masters. They are so good in using language, right? So when they come to these spaces, their presence is also intended to invite the guests to donate more money to either the newlyweds or the new parents, or if it's a funeral, the bereaved family, okay?
Kobe was born in Jamestown, and when I first met him in 2011, he had lived there his entire life until he secured a job at a local NGO called Bring Us Rights and Justice. At the time of my, so I'll call Bring Us Rights and Justice Burge, henceforth. At the time of my fieldwork, Burge was one of few organizations in Ghana to address LGBT human rights issues. Kobe's job therefore provided him with the means to live in a different suburb, located northeast of Jamestown, which income he used to partially support his family. A self-described Sasso, Kobe vacillated between, now listen to this, he vacillated between identifying as gay, Sasue, and on occasion suspending his affiliation to these labels altogether. For example, at his mother's residence, he never disclosed his homoerotic proclivities or even details of the activities he undertook at Birch, the NGO. In this presentation, I invite you to join me take a short ethnographic excursion into my book project, which is an ethnographic examination of queer self-fashioning in neoliberal Ghana. In the book, I explore in what ways the presence of self-identified effeminate men who currently inhabit the nexus of LGBT human rights politics and ideas and a nation state that polices sexual citizenship disrupt monolithic assumptions about sexuality. How do such articulations, I ask, both shape the Ghanaian nation's state's imagination of the country as a heterosexual nation, and how does LGBT human rights organizations also produce monolithic identities as homosexual, right, which we need to think about. And how do rituals like the Eldarin accepted above complicate our understanding of how Sasui navigate their re-identification as homosexuals, thus asserting their legitimacy as valuable bodies amid civil society's onslaught? So what I'm trying to say is that in Ghana, what we are witnessing in the past decade, since 2006, when an international LGBT organization attempted to organize a conference in the country, there's been an increased, you know, homophobic discourse, right? And this increased homophobic discourse has somehow, you know, spilled into our cultural fabric. And this is a cultural fabric that is very homosocial, right? So there's a certain rebranding of homosociality as homosexuality, whereby if, say, two men are working together and are holding hands, they are afraid, even if it's not homosexual, because of fear of being rebranded as homosexual, they don't hold hands. So there's a certain minimization or erosion of these kinds of homosocial bonds. And through my work, I'm trying to basically amplify the ways in which the increased visibility of politics is connected to this erasure of homosociality, right? So thinking about the entanglement that are happening. Now, I have a Muslim wedding here just to also think about the ways in which you do have these effeminate men who dress up and go to weddings. And Muslim wedding like that. Meanwhile, we think about Muslim spaces as very homophobic. So why is it that these men are actually at this space? It's because they have relations to the bride, and the bride invited them, and the bride knew that their presence there would actually make the event or the ritual of the wedding very vibrant. So arguing that life transition rituals are coterminously geographies that enable queer self-fashioning, I show in the project that they also model the boundaries between heteroerotic and homoerotic desires and practices. In that regard, I think about life transition rituals in the sense discussed by the French ethnographer and folklorist Arnold van Gennep, who describes these events as rites which accompany every change of place, state, social position, and age. And because I'm an anthropologist, I really value the ways in which ritualized spaces themselves, the ways in which ritualized spaces lend themselves as very, they're paradoxical, right? In these cases, the most unimagined of relationships are forged, right? And so I'm trying to basically understand or amplify the ways in which the kinds of rituals I observe in the field serve as a platform on which to think about the ways in which heteronormativity and homoeroticism, which are actually imagined as, you know, polar opposites, somehow have these really interesting unimagined alliances. I maintain that the Eldarin ritual is a state on which Sasui simultaneously fashion legitimate and transgressive selves, an unlikely relationship. Secondly, I tend to account philosophical notions of personhood to demonstrate how African philosophy can be harnessed to make sense of queer self-making in neoliberal Ghana. Engaging in particular with the Ghanaian philosopher Kwame Jichi, who asserts that the Akan people of Ghana construct personhood amphibiously, I aim to unsettle the racist dichotomy that pits African homophobia against Western sexual tolerance. To be clear, a ritual such as the Eldarin grounds how Sasui in the era of the increased visibility of LGBT politics and concomitant homophobia amphibiously navigate the uncertain terrains in which their lives are nested. Sasui's subjectivities are therefore contingent on several factors, right, including ritual spaces and Eldarins and working in NGOs like this. So here, you know, this is a Burge event. So I'm trying to make the sense that, you know, the way Sasui actually engage in their own self-fashioning or self-presentations is contingent on the space in which they find themselves. So at this Burge event, which occurred at a different part of the city, they were very careful to dress appropriately, right? Because they didn't want to draw attention from the community in which the organization is. The organization was having an event for homosexuals. So they had to somehow mask their identity, right, by bargaining with sartorialism, right? So they dressed officially to go to this event. The space of the ritual, for instance, affords us with the opportunity to embark on transgressing inflexible gender boundaries, but the space of the NGO, which is to actually help them talk about these things, sometimes reproduces the very gendered boundaries that they are actually, you know, contended, they are transgressing in the ritual spaces. Now, since ethnographic scholarship on Ghana, you know, such as R.S. Rattray's work on the Ashantis, Christina Pond's work on marriage among a matrilineal elite failed to account for the, you know, the numerous occasions of queerness, right? I'm trying to use my work to intervene in these fails. Because what I'm saying is that anthropological literature, like colonial documents and missionary accounts, have actually contributed to this discourse of an African heterosexuality, right? So then the emergence of queer African studies is basically to disrupt this narrative, right, by foregrounding the accounts and experiences of queer bodies such as Sasoe. I argue, therefore, that the birth ceremony I observed was evidently one such moment in which the seams of homoeroticism and heteroeroticism entwined. There not only was cohesion fostered among members of society, but across members of the community. And for Sasue, the outdooring lent itself as an occasion for strengthening bonds that policed their non-normative and sexual subjectivities. Now, this is what Foster, a part-time worker at a local NGO, tells me about the ways in which, you know, the outdooring ceremonies are useful for them. When we attend an outdooring, a wedding or a funeral, we do our very best to add color to it. We do almost everything in unison and concert. And when he says we, he means Sasue. For example, only Sasue can bring some touch of sophistication. Nobody else can do what we do. The styles we present are unique. We wear our outfits, sometimes share the same fabric to appear uniform, although they are sewn differently, right, depending on the wearer's preference. Whether we are invited or not to an event, our presence implies simply that we are going to steal the show. So here, so this is them, right? And when they arrive, like, it's just how they look very gorgeous, right? And they, like, the ways in which they mobilize, you know, the sartorial art, right, to announce their presence is immaculate. But what I also want to say is that the conditions in Ghana, right, in a place where there are colorful fabrics that both men and women use, allow them to play with these dynamics. Right, so they are drawing on these colorful fabrics to do something for themselves, right? In ways that, you know, straight Ghanaians wouldn't do. Foster's penetrative observation articulates how central rituals are for Sasue. By adding style or color, he implies the provocative dances and the dainty clothes that pronounce, define, and announce their sartorial ardor. Animated, he declares, our attires speak for us. These embodied expressions, in addition to their engagement in acts of gender nonconformity, while distressing the feminine-masculine binary, are also unlikely to be condemned in these spaces. In non-ritual spaces, however, they are aware that such expressions might invite negative attention and responses, such as the NGO, right? So they have to be very careful when they are in these spaces. Sasue's sartorial undertones unpack the ways in which space, event, and time inform embodied self-presentations. They also highlight the contingencies defining Sasue modes of self-fashioning and how the space of the ritual emerges as a site for conditioning heteronormativity and heteroeroticism. Sasue active participation in rites of passage parallels the activities that occur during the liminal phase of the ritual process. Introduced by Van Kickgenep, the term liminality was popularized by the anthropologist Victor Turner, which captures the threshold in the ritual process at which the ambiguities that engender anti-structural possibilities come to have a life of their own. The suspension of order, enabling fluidity, malleability, and flexibility in this space, is therefore a crucial feature of anti-structure, as Turner lets us know. I insist, therefore, that Sasue be seen as embodying gender non-conforming dispositions that are themselves anti-structural instantiations of liminality. So my argument is that in this liminal space where all other heteronormative order is suspended, right, and that's paradoxical because, of course, the ritual is a ritual that somehow conditions heteronormativity, yet somehow Sasue, by being there and being involved, allow me to see the paradoxes there are, right, that in this space, although it's a heteronormative ritual that Sasue is acceptable, right, for them to embody their effeminate selves, right? It's really okay for them to inhabit this space just as everyone else. Against this background, Sasue's subjectivities are strengthened in the interstitial thresholds that define rituals. In these ritualized states, their effeminate subjectivities paradoxically come to acquire legitimacy. It can therefore be adduced that Sasue convivialities contribute to a particular social algebra that is constitutively the organizing principle on which the success of the ceremony is measured. And indicators of success include but are not limited to the grandness of the event, how good the food was, the oratorical sophistication of the MC, who is also the amount of drinks guests enjoyed, and the duration of the event. And all of these are actually also done on the backs of Sasue. The outdooring I witnessed with Kobe was coterminously a space where Sasue felt the need to be effeminate without reproach. During the ritual, they evaded sanctions commonly instituted by heteronormativity, norms that enforce compulsory heterosexuality. Furthermore, identifications as LGBT were less likely to be ferreted in these domains. Moreover, Sasso, as a construct that references self-identified effeminate men, underwent several transitions in this space. Right? So basically what I'm trying to say is that the ritualized space actually affords us to have a kaleidoscopic understanding of Sasso, not as a homogeneous category. Right, here is an outdooring where the woman herself is Sasue because she's masculine, right? And the husband of this woman is effeminate and is also Sasue. So you really see the vast array of the motley assortment, if you will, of this universe. It's a very complicated universe that just to assume that Sasue only describes effeminate men is to miss the point, right? Which is why ethnography is so important for those anthropologists who are here. That when we do ethnography, we are going out there to basically, you know, live in the thicket and understand the fact that, you know, mess is part of how we live. It's great. It's good to be messy, right? And so it's a very messy universe, right? And I'm trying to basically use my work to show the ways in which the nation state, the government of Ghana, tries to make this universe homogenous. Just as LGBT human rights organizations also say they are queer, I'm like, but then they are not just queer, they are actually very complicated. It's a multiverse out there, and we need to understand that. So Sasue is therefore a contested site of identification that challenges, where did I put that? That challenges the idea that Ghana is a heterosexual nation. So now, look, when you arrive at Ghana's airport, right, there's this big banner. So this was in 2011. When I arrived, there was this big thing at the airport. So once you go through immigration formalities, you meet this. It says, welcome, Akwaba. Ghana warmly welcome all visitors of goodwill. Ghana does not welcome pedophiles and other sexual deviants. Indeed, Ghana imposes extremely harsh penalties on such sexually aberrant behavior.
So I'm making the argument that the presence of the Sasue community, if you will, somehow disrupts this notion of the Ghanaian nation state as purely heterosexual, right? And also it calls into question, you know, LGBT human rights NGOs labels, LGBT, which can be very tyrannizing because this... They can be tyrannizing because they refuse to accept or they refuse to understand the complex histories behind why Sasue are who they are, how they navigate this space, and the kinds of cultures they have created for themselves in the face of homophobia. Accordingly, Sasue also participate in the tendency of NGO interventions to homogenize them as gay men in some contexts, while actively rejecting it in others. The categorical imperatives of transnational LGBT rights NGOs significantly impact this reality. So, for example, in 2014, an LGBT human rights called AIDSPAN, right, in Kenya, released a documentary that exposed the community of Sasue in Jamestown, titled "I Didn't Want to Bring Shame on My Family, Being Gay in Ghana," highlighting the tragedies faced by men who have sex with men (MSM). Now, just understand the public health category. So, they are not talking about gay now; they are talking about MSM, right? The organization brought their public secret into the open when a popular Sasso featured in a video called Hillary openly declared that he was both gay and lived with HIV. Not taking into account how the Sasue featured in the video besides him would respond, Hillary flaunted his homoerotic inclinations in the public sphere. Creating ripples in Jamestown, regarded then as one of the safe suburbs for and among sexual minorities and gender non-conforming individuals, the video sent some Sasue into hiding.
Sasue does inhabit a complicated zone where they fashion selves that are now recast as non-normative in the cultural context in which they are situated. Simultaneously, however, Sasue's self-making strategies also challenge our understanding of normal, drawing from and complicating established values and practices of their communities. Little surprise, therefore, that the term Sasue in Ga, or its equivalent Sasofo in Akan, interweaves several alternative parts of speech, noun, verb, and adjective. So I basically want to show here how, NGO involvements in many African nations have been helpful, but they have also come with their downsides. For example, I recently analyzed a video produced by BBC. The video was called The World's Worst Place to Begin. I don't know if anyone of you have seen that video, but it's on Uganda. And the projection of Uganda in that video is so interesting, right? I mean, talking about Uganda as the world's worst place to begin, right? Somehow, for viewers in the West, when they think about Uganda as the world's worst place to begin, it's easy for them to think about Uganda as the entire African continent, right? So that Uganda becomes a synecdoche here of Africa, which means that if Uganda is the world's worst place to be gay, then Africa is the world's worst place to be gay. But what is also insidious in this narrative is the fact that it reproduces this heart of darkness narrative, right? Whereby Africa becomes the heart of homophobic darkness, right? So these are the kinds of narratives I'm trying to, disrupt by, making Sasue tell their stories themselves, right? That, yes, there's homophobia there, but we shouldn't sort of, Africa is not reducible to homophobia, right? And plus the fact that it was not homosexuality was always in Africa, but homophobia was imported to Africa. Our history will tell you that. So I'm trying to show the ways in which these NGOs somehow render the lives of these men vulnerable. Right. Meanwhile, these men have ways of actually navigating the vulnerabilities that are imposed on them or instigated by these NGOs. So I would like for us to see the ways in which Sasue is, it's a very complicated category, right? Now, in the universe of Sasue, you do have Sasue as, the self-identified kind of man, but Sasue itself means co-equal. Right, so I'm trying to understand why these men, right, choose to call themselves Sasue, which etymologically does not mean self-identifying feminine man. But then I think the story underlining that is the fact that they see themselves as effeminate or somehow gender non-conforming. So by being gender non-conforming, it becomes that denominator that binds them, right? So they are equal. Right, so then they are actually somehow riffing on co-equality originally to call themselves self-identified effeminate or deflecting these fixed gender categories. Right, so they share that relationship and for which they call themselves Sasue. So I'm interested in how or the ways in which Sasue is not just a noun, right? It's also an adjective, right? And it describes men who actually are not just effeminate, but trosiaris, sachets around. And they also call themselves auntie or sister. So let me just read a short anecdote for you. Disrupting the idea that Sasue are a homogeneous constituency, Ayikwe, a hairdresser, expressed that all Sasue are not the same. We have different styles and we express them differently, but most importantly, we are people, we are human, we feel too. An ethnographic reading of Ayikwe's intimation, I argue, suggests the impossibility of uniformity while stressing the collective humanity of Sasue expressed here as a noun. Desmond, the food vendor in Jamestown, describes Sasue as a man who sashays around, swinging their wrists in a twirling fashion, throws around their wrists effortlessly without fear of sanctions, and possessing the gait of a model. I'll call such a person a sister or better yet auntie. Sasue are like that. Sometimes too, when we exaggerate, it is like you see in RuPaul. Some of us like that show. So also think about the ways in which they have ingested these Western ideas of, queerness, right? So when I talk about the ways in which these Sasue is not just it's not authentic. It's also a blend of other forms of queerness, right? That we need to understand as circulating within what is called the queer international. Desmond's assertion incorporates his understanding of
queer identity from the United States. As he embroiders his familiarity with RuPaul's Drag Race together with local descriptions of gender non-normative men, unlike Ayikwe, Desmond presents an adjectival modality of Sasue self-making. It may appear that effeminacy is a significant reference point among Sasue. However, there are moments in which an overly effeminate presentation of the self invites rebuke from those Sasue who prefer to cloak their effeminacy in secrecy. So in the Sasue universe, there are also men, right? Here people call them street acting men, or men who are on the down low. And these are usually actually somehow cut along, or they are intersected along the lines of class. So they are gentos and logs. Gentos are the gentlemen, and gentos are mostly married men who somehow have these surreptitious or clandestine relationships with Sasue. And they are the logs. The logs are the hustlers in Jamestown, right? And they are mostly dependent on Sasue because Sasue tend to be very industrious. Now let me tell you a story. I was once walking through Jamestown and this is someone else's story, so So one of my interlocutors tells me that they were walking through the streets of Jamestown and a woman calls them, right? She summons them to come to her. And then the woman tells her, right, that, my husband thinks you're a very beautiful man. I want you to sleep with him. This is a married woman. He is married to me, right? So my friend is like, how do we do about it? Right, so apparently the woman was looking out for her husband, right? And what I want to actually add here is that what I'm seeing in this space, in Jamestown in particular, is that the woman is very aware, right, that homosexuality is actually criminalized in Ghana. Right, so Ghana has inherited this colonial relic through its constitution, whereby it criminalizes homosexuality. Right, so if anything at all, she as a heterosexual woman, right, married to a man who is interested in a man, stands a better chance of preserving her marriage if her husband sleeps with a man rather than a woman, because the woman is much more likely to break down her marriage, a man can't. Right, so these are some of the ways in which we need to think about how heteronormativity gets preserved by this kind of homoerotic alliances. And that's what I want to think about when I think about entanglement, that we need not actually just, look at heteronormativity as this demon, right? That somehow there are moments in which it's entangled, or its sustenance is actually contingent on homoeroticism. And this is how I'm trying to use these experiences amongst Sasue to show the multifariousness of heteronormativity itself. That it's not just, of course there's a hegemonic heteronormativity, so what are the peripheral or marginal heteronormativities there are? They also need to be accounted for, really. So one of my central arguments in this work is to argue that Sasue's subjectivity making is not only queer, but also particularly Ghanaian. And much like the anthropologist Gloria Wecker, who argues that Mati practices in Suriname resurrected aspects of West African sexual grammatology and personhood, I maintain the view that Sasue express affective registers inflected by colonialism, Christianity, and racialized capitalism. They are, to reiterate the terminology deployed by the Ghanaian philosopher Kwame Jeti, subjects who constantly engage in the practice of amphibious identification. So that's Kwame Jeti. For Jeti, the modality of self-making, this Akan modality of self-making exudes, and I quote, features of both communality and individuality. In this order, argues Jeti, life is lived in harmony and cooperation with others, a life of mutual consideration and aid and of interdependence, but simultaneously a life that provides a viable framework for the fulfillment of the individual's nature and potentials. Refusing to homogenize the comprehension of self-making among the Akan, Jeti proceeds to explain just how, quote, the African social order is neither purely communalistic or purely individualistic.
Jyoti Das insists that the individuals within the social order are not entirely crushed by the community, as they have latitude for the self-assertion required to define their humanity and personhood. To justify the logic undergirding why and how that can particularly articulate amphibious identification for making sense of their self-making, Jyoti highlights a motley assortment of proverbs that instantiate modes of self-making among their kind. So here are some of the proverbs, right? When a man descends from heaven, he descends into a human society. The prosperity or well-being of man depends upon his fellow man. So just think about, Jyoti is a very Ghanaian man, so it's very gendered, right? And we need to think about just that. So one finger cannot lift up a thing. The clan is like a cluster of trees, which when seen from afar, appear huddled together, but which would be seen to stand individually when closely, approached. Now, these proverbs, I'm trying to retrieve or resurrect the significance of African philosophy for theorizing queer subjectivities in Africa, because there are very few queer theorists of African descent who use African philosophy. And my goal is to basically show the ways in which these existing African philosophical designations can help us enrich and also complicate the ways in which men like Sassoon embody queer self-fashioning in neoliberal Ghana. So Jyoti proceeds to reference the Dinkra symbol Funtumfunefu, Denchemfunefu, which transliterate as the Siamese crocodiles, to explain his thesis on amphibious identification. The Siamese crocodiles is a crocodile that is double-headed yet conjoined in the belly. For Jyoti, this symbol is constitutively a metaphor that not only captures amphibious self-fashioning, but also demonstrates the tensions and the torsions that define the self-styling process. So here, the crocodile has two heads. That's one head, and that's the other head. They have one belly. They both fight. The two heads are constantly embroiled in the battle over food that goes into the one belly. What Jyoti is saying is that, well, because Africans have been imagined by anti-colonial anthropologists as very communal, and Jyoti is basically trying to dismantle that narrative by arguing that, no, amongst Africans, there is communalism and individualism, and that these two forms of being are always in tension, right? So he uses this to basically capture the ways in which the Akan people embark on self-fashioning. Right, that yes, they are aware they are in a community, but then their being in a community is contingent on struggle and navigating, other persons, right? So I use this metaphor to basically capture how Sassoe are also embedded in multiple universes. One which is a country that lends itself as heterosexual, and another which is the LGBT human rights regime. That how do Sassoe navigate these modes of self-identification amphibiously, right? Because on the one hand, the LGBT human rights organizations come into Ghana and tell them you are gay. And on the other hand, the nation state tells them you are heterosexual. So how are they navigating these tensions in this precarious space? So by centering Jyoti's analytic here, I contemplate for a moment just how Sassoe, like Hillary, the gay man I mentioned earlier, positioned themselves within, against, and on the frontiers of colonial, Christian, and post-colonial identifications and queer liberal categorizations. Sassoe life was consistently showed that these categories are unsteady. For example, by articulating gay identity in the documentary produced by A-Span, Hillary draws on queer liberal nomenclature, right? This is a nomenclature that is not familiar to Ghanaians. Yet he also carefully struts the muddy terrains of his subjectivities in a conversation I had with him in the summer of 2012. And this is my question to him. So does your family know about your sexual encounters with men? And this is Hillary's response to me. It's really hard to tell. I don't tell them that I do Sasso. Mind you, he says, I don't tell them I do Sasso, because Sasso is for those men who are called gentles and logs, right? They are called Sasso because they engage in the act of homoeroticism, not because they are effeminate, right? So here, the act of homoeroticism becomes like doing or engaged in the homosexual activity, right? So they only know I don't tell them I do Sasso. They only know that I am Sasso, right? I respect them And so when I'm around them, I'm very careful about what I say or what I do. I may be comfortable joking around with friends about my sexual encounters. However, I have to be sure that jokes about my sexual encounters with men are muted when I am around members of my family. It is very difficult to even tell my mother that I'm a peer counselor for men who have sex with men at the NGO. She only knows that I work on HIV-related projects. As for my sister, I believe she's aware of my homosexual encounters because she has female friends who sleep with women and are also my good friends. However, I believe she understands, that's her sister. On the other hand, my mother is very humble and a respectable member of my family and the community, and I don't want to break her heart. Kwame, many Sasue are in the same shoes as me. Most of us don't talk about our lives with men. For those who have done it, the consequences have been grave. We would rather live our lives under the carpet rather than live openly as gay men. You know, all of this is out of respect. Because once you say you are gay in this community, it reflects not so well on your entire family and community. People will talk and say stuff about your family, and most of us want to avoid the consequences that our homosexuality can bring. So one better place it in secret. So this is where Hillary seems to be bargaining with heteronormativity, right? But doing it in a way that is also tactical. And mind you, I actually get the term bargaining from the Turkish feminist called Deniz Kandiyoti, who talks about patriarchal bargaining, right? How women in spaces of patriarchy somehow have to bargain with patriarchy, but then we need not think about the act of bargaining as oppressive, but as a strategy and a tactic to navigate and to prove to patriarchy that it's actually a loose institution and not, you know, so fast and rigid. We need to view Hillary's response as emblematizing how he embodied selves that were at once contradictory and coherent. These selves, which I call amphibious, are neglected by H-Span together with a nation state that criminalizes homosexuality. In the above narrative, Hillary articulates a self deeply embedded in his family, in which he masks his engagement in homoeroticism or his healthcare outreach for MSMs. Although his family partially relied on him for financial assistance, derived from his participation in a local NGO called Birch, his LGBT organizing activities in these organizations, right, was shrouded in secrecy both by him and those who knew about the entrails of his employment. So then the Sasue as a community are themselves very protective of their secrets, right? And the societies in which you are embedded, in Jamestown, the community knows that these men engage in homoerotic acts, right? So it's like a public secret, right? But then once the NGOs intervene, it becomes a public knowledge. And now these are the kinds of tragedies they are having to navigate. Undercutting the fact that Hillary may have been navigating the uncertain landscape amphibiously, the H-Span video rendered its subjectivity homogeneous and simultaneously queer, victimized and plagued by HIV. Hence, I stress here that we move beyond narratives of queer victimology and of gay men as vectors of HIV, which often reinforces African homophobia, to reconfiguring Hillary's subjectivity as possessing multiple competing, contradictory, and even libertine selves. Moreover, these cells are on occasion utterly incomprehensible to his family, the residents of Jamestown, fellow Sasue and friends, and to I, the ethnographer. Hillary embodies cells that intertwine nervously, particularly as he moves between spaces among people within organizations and while painfully enduring an immune deficiency disease. Moreover, by drawing on strategies of the self, which I describe as amphibious subjectivity, Hillary collapsed the constitution of Sasui as a verb, noun, and an adjective. Having been seasonally employed at the NGO, Hillary was a subject with access to a salary job and connections to Western human rights NGOs. Such organizations in Ghana, perceived as inflated of American dollars and European euros, make one's affiliation or association with them respectable in the public sphere. In conclusion, then, I maintain that Hillary ultimately straddled the realm of respectability and unrespectability. For instance, Hillary's access to the trickling streams millions of queer dollars, situated him squarely in the race towards phallic competence, which Akosua Adumafu Ampofu Agi was contingent on biological fatherhood, marriage, and men's reproductive capacities. So what I'm trying to say here is that by virtue of his proximity to these NGOs that were literally inflated with queer dollars, Hillary made elevated his class status, right? And such elevation made him masculine, right? But such masculinity was undercut by his effeminacy, right? So we need to really understand the ways in which gender, class, and all these things, and I think these are things we know, somehow make complex Sasue dispositions. However, his unmarried status, the shifting meanings attached to his effeminacy, and his alien health opened him to reprimand. Overall, what is identity, one may ask, for Hillary, who is wedged between a transnational LGBT human rights movement and a nation state and a civil society that continues to police and make bleak prospects for queer citizenship? This is perhaps a question I respond to in my book, by highlighting how Sasue navigation of queer politics and heteronationalist politics, make us understand the utility or usefulness of amphibious self-making. Hillary's identity, much like the identity of the colonized subject described by Stuart Hall, the cultural studies theorist, is formed then at, and I quote, the unstable point where the unspeakable stories of subjectivity meet the narratives of a history, a culture. And since he or she is positioned in relation to cultured narratives which have been profoundly expropriated, the colonized subject is always somewhere else, doubly marginalized, displaced always other than where he or she is or is able to speak from. And it's that kind of position or location that's where Hillary operates from. Thank you very much.
I think that when we study like oppressed communities, so often we can get into trying to resist narratives, but not trying to like amplify them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've like noticed more like now and kind of like my. And like my idea of like how I think about blackness, like it's not oppressed. Mm-hmm. It's a different thing that has. So like, how did you come to that? How did you come to like making this framework? And how did that occur to you? I think that's something that was like really unique and stood out in your presentation. So like, what made you come to that realization? And like, what is it? Yeah.
One, I was interested in what's her name, please?
Anna Shell.
It has to do with when I started this work, I was quite worried about the absence of African theory, African philosophy, and the fact that the very idea of African philosophy somehow comes to sound oxymoronic, right? Because people don't imagine between the African theories and the African philosophers. Right, but also I think that was one thing I wanted to rescue. I wanted to utilize African scholars more in my work, right? So they can also sit around the tables or participate in the corridors in which these queer theoretical discussions happen. But secondly, having been in the US, right, where I came into my blackness, right, and for which I came to understand just how complicated blackness is. But blackness is not this homogeneous whole, right? That is just this very complicated universe of so many things. I understood, right, the ways in which we on the both sides of the Atlantic have inherited or ingested, right, blackness or Africans, right? So I think my quest for challenging hegemonic narratives, right, is also derived from how these men speak for themselves. That what do we have to learn from the people we study, right? And as an ethnographer, I'm challenged by that question all the time. Because very often we go into these communities acting like we are going to rescue them. And I don't want to participate in rescue politics, because it's a very violent and dangerous thing, right? What I want to do is to help them teach me their ways, their language, right? And ethnography somehow affords us the opportunity. So I arrived at that through the people I just spoke to, they are the people who taught me to think about African theory. Right, so I mean, it was easy for me because apparently their lives were already doing this theory for me. Right, so it was precisely that their lives that compelled me to think about, oh my God, I need to think about the utility of African ways of thinking. Right, and if queer African studies should come to have a life of its own, then we have to deeply appreciate, right, the richness on the ground, something that we often overlook, either by sanitizing or by trying to make everything clean. My goal is to make things messy, right, to just show how, you know, queer politics to free poor queer Africans is no different from how the state oppresses queer Africans, right, because it comes in with this, you know, tyrannizing on nomenclature. Just as the state is actually saying, well, Africans are not together, we are all straight. Right, so these are the kinds of things I've learned from the community, that by having that exposure to their lives, I'm able to see just how complex, how multifarious their lives are, you know, using their language, how they express themselves. And so it's really something I learned from them. They taught me how to do my work. Questions?
I have a question. You spent a lot of time at the University of Ghana in Accra. I'm curious to know how students, or undergraduate, the graduate students there, how they navigate this position.
That's a very good point. I mean, so to look at the space of the university is very different, because then we do have this kind of, unfortunately, the binary of the town and gown.
Right.
And for which, you know, a lot of the students at the University of Ghana who see themselves as highly educated, all of the men who are, the men I studied in Jamestown, most of whom are actually not as educated, right, would say they are gay, because they are actually educated, right, so they have access to the language and very vocally self-identify as gay. So what I'm seeing in my research is the contentions, right, along the lines of class and educational education between Sasoe and these gay men who are pursuing their degrees at the university. Right? So on the one hand, they are also Ghanaian. Like the NGO I worked for had, like, the manager was the executive officer had a degree and called himself gay. And so there were tensions in the field between him and the Sasoe, because the Sasoe felt he was pretty detached from their universe. Right? So somehow the students at the University of Ghana, I mean, there's now like a sizable queer community, although they are still under the carpet, right? But then they would boldly self-identify as gay. Right? And the Sasoe are those who vacillate back and forth, right? Being selective as to how to self-identify. And I must add that, you know, somehow saying you are gay as an NGO, or saying you are an NGO that deals with gay or LGBT communities attracts a lot of funding, right? So then gay becomes like a strategic nomenclature, or LGBT becomes a strategic term that they drop into their proposals, because that's where we are going to get the money from, which is what I'm talking about, you know, the LGBT human rights industrial complex.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's really what's happening. Sorry.
Somebody had.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. The next part is, you know, in places like Jamestown, where I'm sure they still have some traditional governance systems, how does that impact persons who are allowed to hold, you know, position in a community?
So Jamestown is interesting because it's very working class. I think, you know, I always say either revolution should happen, the working class would be good. Because, you know, Jamestown, as it were, is still a very masculine space. It's a fishing community, it's a pugilist community. So, like, there, you can't see the erosion much of this homosocial bonding between men. But we also have to understand the fact that Jamestown has a very interesting history of boys cross-dressing, right? So a lot of the fishermen in this community will go on their fishing expeditions, right, with boys who are cross-dressing. the goal of which was to actually ensure success in the African expeditions. Right, so then these cross-dressed boys were assumed or believed to possess some supernatural power, right? And that allowed for cross-dressed fishing expeditions, right? So there's that history there, and there are some fetish priests, some traditional priests in the community who themselves embody, right, non-binary gender. I mean, they are non-binary. They believe they are men, but then they think that the spirits that mount them are female, right? And so the cosmology somehow is flexible, such that the appearance or the presence of these men is acceptable. Except that, so the argument I make is that the visibility of LGBT politics and the imposition of LGBT as an identity can be violent. I'm not saying all the time, but it's being violent because it's eroding this thing because of the kind of baggage it comes with, right? And also Ghana is currently really completely Christianized. It's really very violent Christianity, right? That is connected to a neo-colonial regime that is also becoming violent.
Yeah.
But I hope that answers your
question. Thank you. So yeah, this actually falls through that a little bit. I was thinking of those two images, the one at the beginning, the slaving fortresses,
mm-hmm.
and then the sign prohibiting sexual deviance,
mm-hmm.
and about the history that connects them. So
mm-hmm.
I was thinking, you know, the fortresses are places where the families are broken.
Right.
The 18th century, the 19th century, Ghana is colonized,
mm-hmm.
and then 20th century, Africa, presumably that was a post-colonial
right.
sign.
Mm-hmm.
They're setting up this sign, ostensibly to protect the family,
mm-hmm.
again,
mm-hmm.
from outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering, first of all, what kind of role the 18th century slaving past of Ghana, or generally Ghana's history, plays in debates over sexuality, and but also about the laws,
mm-hmm.
like the laws that we're referring to
mm-hmm.
in the signs,
mm-hmm.
are they still relics of
yeah.
of those codes? And then finally also this question of the tourists that are coming,
mm-hmm.
the who are going to see Cape Coast Castle
mm-hmm.
and all those places,
mm-hmm.
and whether that sign has is it directed at them? Is it true?
That's a very, I like the symbolic significance of that question. So, yes, obviously, I like the relic as text and relic as texture, because these are like building material structures, right? And of course, the constitution is a textual relic, right? What I'm trying to convey in the work is the fact that Ghanaians have repurposed Christianity, right? And I feel it's one of the new colonial quagmires we have to contend with, right? So I was saying earlier on that somehow we have to come to terms with the fact that we as Africans and African descended people, and maybe white people too, have been scrambled by this colonial project and enslavement, right? So what we are seeing in this landscape, if you will, reflects the scrambled existence, right? And so Ghanaians wouldn't talk about this history, right, but would rather say, no, we are not that. And so might that conversation reflect a certain post-trauma of enslavement, right? And that's what I can look at. Because what is really happening is that when Ghana received its independence in 1957, we thought we had received that independence. And Kwame Nkrumah is right when he talks about new colonialism, that, well, we had only received political independence, but we never got to receive economic independence or moral independence. Because what is happening is that, or what was happening at the time was that you have the British, right, continuing projects in Ghana along the lines of the nuclear family. Right, so the organizations like Christian Aid, which is a British-based organization, working closely with the Christian Council of Ghana to facilitate a project called the Christian Marriage and Family Life outreach campaign. And this went on for 10 years. And this project somehow engendered the idea that polygamy was evil, polygamy was primitive, polygamy was African. So for Africans to actually transcend, right, the trials of incivility, that they have to become monogamous, embrace Christian marriage, and adopt a nuclear family. Right, so who are the key leaders? And these were the newly elected Ghanaian political leaders and Ghanaian Christian ministers who are pursuing these campaigns, right? So in fact, I would say that there's a certain refusal to talk about this, you know, and so in my work I'm trying to think about the ways in which this conversation produces artificial amnesia, right? Both for the LGBT human rights outreach folks, those who come from the West and those in Ghana, and the Ghanaian political, but they're all forgetting about history, right? That, you know, if they call Uganda the world's worst place to be gay, well, what was the history that actually produced that homophobia? They don't talk about that. Just as the nation state, right, the African leaders refuse to or forget the fact that, well, they have inherited a colonial state and a colonial constitution. So that's why I'm trying to actually, you know, map out the affinity between the LGBT minority movements and the state, that they are really somehow, they think they are for our country, they're really entangled in so many ways. So yeah, I'm really, really keen on thinking about how the family is, in Ghana right now, it's all about the family, but then the families, like the nuclear family in particular, because that is what Ghanaians see as, you know, the turbine for modernity, right? And so, and not just modern, but Christian modernity, right? And you have the queer liberal modernity, which sees sexual tolerance as a new modernity, so that there are these competing modernities. And this is why Sasue have to navigate carefully these, you know, spaces in ways that would ensure your survival. So I talk so much, sorry.
It's actually a question about your approach and your method in the field. And part of what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking also about our students who are considering perhaps doing field research, mm-hmm. right? But I'm also thinking about you as a person, you as an ethnographer, and I'm also thinking about myself too, and how, like, sometimes when I know I'm going to a particular place, a particular culture, I will prepare myself by packing certain things.
Yes.
So I'm going to pack, like, stuff I consider modest clothing to go to my Islamic context, right? Or I might arm myself with certain words, or say I'm going to take these words out of my vocabulary. How do you prepare for the field? You say you're going to Ghana on Monday. And in what ways do you package yourself so that you can enter into conversations with folks on the ground and hear what they're saying?
Right. I mean, that's the beauty of field work. Ethnography is also like a theater, you know, given from this idea. When I'm in Ghana, very different. I don't even dress like this, you know, because, you know, to dress in a certain way would actually announce who you are or what you do. And Ghanaians talk a lot, you know. You talk about everything, you know, like, you see gays. I mean, I had, an anecdote, like, there's this anthropologist friend of mine who is very, she's a woman, she's queer, right? And so she goes to Ghana, she's a white woman, she has short hair, and she's walking through the market, and, you know, she understood the language, and she's like, she could overhear the women at the market asking whether, is that a man or a woman, right? And then one says, well, look at her phone to see whether she has a breast, right? And then she responds to them in the language and they all flee, they run away, because they didn't know she understood the language. But my point is that, you know, I have to prepare myself for that trip. And, you know, it's also the fact that I've been here for 11 years. So I'm very, very different. My tastes have literally changed, right? So again, I think one thing I'm doing my work to do is to call to question the notion of a native ethnographer. At what point does the ethnographer become native? Is the native ethnographer really native, right? And so it's helpful, you know. At what point does it become a useful thing to do? So, you know, yeah, I go in with these ideas. Then I arrive and I realize that, oh, the context, they are your language, so just go, you know, just go in there and, you know, explore, because you go in with, I went into these theories and then realized that they were not working, but ethnography itself is fodder, it feeds theory, right, that these men told me all these things and I began to feel, they taught me not to think about theory, right, so just let yourself go, really. Oh, oh, sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, in Ghana, brass used to be like the center of life. Yeah, I was just wondering how sexual identity is expressed in the work area, like,
I mean, they are expressed there, but very discreetly, right? So again, I'm going back to my notion of public secrecy, right? That people do know that these kinds of formations and constituencies exist, right? But then we have no names, right? So I'm thinking about the ways in which naming can be violent, right? Naming it to these forms of practices fixed, right? So somehow in the rural settings they are very prevalent, but they do not talk about them. Right? They do talk about them, but it's all under the radar. And in the cities, because of the cosmopolitanism, right, because of the exposure to these labels, because of the internet, right, because of the poor drug rates, right, that these are refashioning these sexual subjectivities in ways that you wouldn't find in the rural settings. Right, but then my point is that in the rural settings, they have their own ways of thinking and talking about these things. And I talk about the traditional priest, right, who is mounted by the spirit, right, supposedly. And where do you usually find that? In the rural areas, right, and then they are accepted as an integral fabric of these communities, as it were. So they are there. I mean, it's really interesting. Last question, please.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ben, for your presentation. My question is how Cecily receive NGOs that do work in the advocacy and the work of the community. How involved Cecily like in these NGOs, or how decisively not involved? Or,
I think you should write the last chapter of my book. Because that's what I'm actually, it's really, now we have formed the our own organization, but the NGOs don't seem to really have a bearing on what Sasori want, right? So they are mobilizing themselves to form an organization. So in April, one of their leaders will be visiting me at UVA, but we are having this anthropological workshop on collaboration, right? So he's my collaborator, and he's coming to visit me for us to basically talk about, you know, how do anthropologists as intellectuals, right, collaborate with activists in the field? You know, I'm interested in the lab of activist work and all of that. So we are bringing in St. Charlesville to talk about the work we do. So, and this is all in response to the work I've done, that you know, these NGOs that come in to dictate to subscribe to do this and that somehow fail to see the, you know, the litigities that animate the existence and all. And so this organization has been formed in response to the gap. Right, and it's really tried then, you know, they are getting a lot of attention and traction. I hope it doesn't morph to become like, you know, these other NGOs. But that's my fear, that these things are kind of, yeah. But that's good, yeah.